nervous habit he used to display in meetings back when we were teachers together. Back before everything, when we were still falling in love. But I remind myself that we are so not anywhere near falling in love anymore. He left me. He's not sorry about that. And I inherited this house. And why? Because maybe this is all part of the big life Blix thought I should have. I can't very well tell him that, though. He gets up and starts pacing in circles around the middle of the room, rubbing his hair. But you were in touch with her since the wedding. Did you know she was doing this? Have you ever talked to her? I sigh, very heavily, to show him that I am nearing the end of my patience with this line of questioning. Look, I talked to her once, one time, but she didn't say anything about this, I swear. And I didn't even know she was sick, much less dying. Tell me the truth, just so I know. Did you somehow get her to do this to get back at me? Noah! You know me better than that. But now you're going to sell it? That's what your mother said. Are you going to be able to sell that house? Those were her exact words. She was practically screaming it. So, that's what you're planning, right? I don't say anything. Yeah, that's what you're planning. Oh my God. And here's what's so ironic. If you sell it, then what? You'll take the money and move to some 3-bedroom house in the suburbs, won't you? You don't even care about it. He keeps shaking his head in disbelief. Too unbelievable. Just incredible. But that was my Aunt Blix in a nutshell. Totally zigging when you thought she was going to zag. Always keep him guessing. Then he stops walking and sighs. And you know what? What I'm most sorry about here? The conversation I'm about to have with my mother. She's going to have a million things to blame me for in this little scenario. Trust me.
Well, I do feel bad for you.
He laughs. No, you don't. This is all fucking unbelievable. You know that? I was the one here when my great aunt dies, and yet somehow she manages to say nothing to me at all about the house or what's going to happen. So I, of course, just assume I can stay here because it'll belong to my family. And then you show up.
There's a loud noise from downstairs.
What's that?
I say.
He runs his hands through his hair. I told you, there's a guy living down there. He has a life. Sometimes he drops things.
What's his name?
Patrick Delaney. He's disabled in some big way. Burn victim. Doesn't come out much.
I think I'm going to take a walk. I'll see if he's okay.
I can't stand looking at Noah for one more minute. Now he's pacing again. Wait, I just thought of something. Do you think it's possible that she left the house to both of us before we got divorced, and that my letter didn't come to me yet because I was in Africa, and that what my mom wants is to tell me that there's this letter for me from the law firm? Is there any way that could be what's happening?
Maybe, I say. Actually, I have an appointment to meet with the attorney on Monday at 10. Why don't you come with me, and maybe we can get some answers?
Okay,
he says after a moment.
At least I can tell my mom that.
I get up off the floor and go outside, closing the big, heavy door behind me. Even though it's night, it's still bright from the streetlights, and there are plenty of people outside, walking their dogs, talking into their phones. There's a coffee place 4 doors up the street, filled with people wearing scarves and jackets. I go down the little stairs to the basement apartment. It's narrow and dark, and probably infested with New York cockroaches and rats, but I bravely knock on the door anyway. I keep my eyes on my feet, just in case something should try to run across them. No answer, so I knock again, and then again, and again. There are bars on the windows. I shudder. Finally, there's a muffled voice from inside.
Yes?
I put my mouth near the door. Patrick? Listen, my name is Marnie. I'm Blix's friend, I guess you'd say. Or maybe grandniece-in-law. Friend sounds better, though. Anyway, I was upstairs and I heard a crash. I just wanted to check you're okay. There's a pause, and then the voice says, more muffled than before,
I'm fine.
Okay, I say. Well, good night, then. Another pause. Then, when I've given up on him having anything else to say, I hear, closer to the door this time,
Welcome to Brooklyn, Marnie. Is Noah with you?
I lean against the door, close my eyes, almost brought to my knees by the question, and the kindness of his voice.
He is, I say finally.
Well, not now, but he's upstairs. I think I'm going to go over to the coffee place and get something to eat. You want to come?
I'm sorry, but I can't.
Well, that's okay. Can I bring you back something then?
No. Thanks. Listen, Blix has my number upstairs. Call any time you need something.
Thanks. Can I give you my number, if you need anything?
Sure. Slide it in the mail slot, will you?
When I get back upstairs, Noah has gone into the back bedroom and closed the door. I can hear him talking, though, no doubt on the phone with his mom. His voice is rising and falling, and when I pass by, I hear,
I'm trying to explain to you. She's here now.
The larger bedroom at the front of the house, with its sienna-colored walls, is open, so I go in there and close the door. The room is kind of surreal, with posters everywhere and a big, lumpy double bed, a Kanta quilt, and all kinds of crazy little knickknacks on every surface, and crystals and banners hanging on the walls, little pieces of art. Pieces that Blix no doubt loved, and that still seemed to hold on to some part of her. I lie there looking up at the ceiling, which is illuminated by the streetlights. You could shoot a movie in this room, it's so bright. The ceiling has a crack that looks like a sweet little chipmunk eating a burrito. Don't give up. Everything is going to be fine, the chipmunk says. It's all unfolding just the way it's supposed to. It's a long time before I can close my eyes and go to sleep. And that's the end of the first day. 23. Marnie. Noah already seems to be gone when I wake up in the morning, which is nothing short of a divine blessing. I take a shower in Blix's fabulous claw-footed tub and then go up to the kitchen where I have to search for a coffee maker. She has some press device that seems to be missing some key parts. There's hardly any food in the refrigerator, just bags of dark chocolate and green mushy things, possibly lentils, and some bottles that look like dietary supplements. And of course, beer. Lots and lots of beer. Luckily, as I'm about to plan a journey into the outside world in search of food, there's a knock at the back door. Hello? Calls Jessica. I open it to find her standing there, wearing a pink-flowered kimono and blue jeans, her wet hair tied up in one of those divinely messy knots.
Oh, hi, she says. I just wondered if you might want to get some breakfast with me.
She makes a sad face. The truth is that my ex, Sammy's dad, came and picked him up this morning, and that's always tough for me. So I could use a little distraction. And I'm guessing you might possibly want to get out of here, too.
I'd love to.
Well, great. I can show you the neighborhood. Park Slope rocks, you know.
I go grab my thin little good-enough-for-Florida sweater, and she dashes into her apartment to get her real sweater. Then she tells me about all the great places around here. As we're leaving, Lola waves to us from the stairs next door and calls out,
You doing okay, Marnie? Settling in? I'm doing fine, Lola.
I holler, and she says,
Come over sometime. I have stories to tell you.
Jessica murmurs,
She and Blix, such a pair. Always out on the stoop talking to everybody who came by. playing with the babies, inviting the old people to come sit with them. Blix knew everybody.
It's a beautiful day outside, warm for October 1st, Jessica says, and the sidewalk is filled with people. Kids in soccer uniforms heading off to games, families with strollers, groups of young guys all wearing black clothing decorated in zippers. A man on the corner who seems to be lecturing a brick building, a guy setting out buckets of flowers in front of a little grocery store. Cars lurch along the streets, then come to screeching halts as people double park and jump out to run into various shops, setting off spates of annoyed honking and swearing. And although everything that happens makes me jump, Jessica pays no attention to what's going on. I keep wanting to slow down and soak it all in, pause somewhere and just watch for a while. But Jessica is walking along at a brisk 30 miles per hour pace, cheerfully ranting about Sammy's father, who cheated on her while they were married, and who is now living with that woman. And now the judge has said that Jessica is supposed to be sharing custody with him. Can I even imagine? She has to share weekend time every other week. The precious time she has to be alone with her own son. The time when they're free from work and school responsibilities. And now she has to share that with her ex, the scumbag, the guy she calls Creeposaurus. I know what you're probably thinking, and you're absolutely right. I should get over it already. He's Sammy's father, and Sammy needs to see him. But, and this is a big but, he lost some of his privileges when he betrayed me. And how can I get over that? Anyway, she looks over at me, and I see that she is puffed up with anger, puffed up and beautiful in her outrage. You've had some complicated stuff, too, I gather. All of Blix's people have. I mean, you were with Noah, for starters.
Complicated, yes, I say, and she says, hey, what's your policy about waiting online for a table?
There's this excellent place I love, but it takes monumental patience because it's so awesome, and also it's got hundreds of reviews on Yelp.
I'm fine with waiting, I say, even though my stomach is growling. I'm surprised she can't hear it.
Great, because it is the place for eggs in Park Slope. You like eggs, I hope.
And it's southern food, which I know you'll like.
Goes with your accent.
Oh, here we are. See how cute?
It's called Yolk.
Sure enough, we've arrived at a tiny little place that has about 30 people milling around outside, sipping mugs of coffee and chatting. Inside, I can see that there are approximately 5 tables we'll be competing for. But we put our name on the list, and then she suggests we walk around, look in the shops. I try to resign myself to the fact that I won't get breakfast until sometime in the middle of next week.
I know it must be so much worse for you, but I still can't believe Blix isn't here any longer, she says. I miss her so much. It's like my own grandmother died or something.
I saw her every single day.
Sammy couldn't leave the house without stopping by her place.
She was everything.
Did you know her for a long time? I say.
Since Andrew left. I met her that same week. So yeah, 3 years? But it seems so much longer because she was always the person I could talk to about anything. She was like my guru and my grandmother and my therapist and my Reiki master and my best friend, all rolled into one. Even while she was sick, she kept up with everybody.
I didn't even know she was sick. I met her last Christmas, and then she came to my wedding, but that's it.
Oh, my goodness.
She loved you a lot. She told everybody about you. The whole borough of Brooklyn probably knew that you were coming. And then Noah showed up right before she died, so I thought that might mean you weren't coming after all. But I couldn't ever get her alone to ask her, you know?
I hope you don't mind that I know all this. That's the way it is when you're one of Blix's people. We all seem connected somehow.
I have to admit that I didn't know I was one of Blix's people.
No? There are a bunch of us.
I met most of them at the wake slash goodbye party she gave for herself.
Did you know about that?
Sadly, I am way out of the loop on everything.
I'll fill you in then,
she says. There's Patrick downstairs. He's an amazing person, an artist and sculptor, but he doesn't come upstairs anymore since she died. Have you seen his sculpture in Blix's living room? The woman holding her hands up near her face? Incredibly beautiful. Too bad he doesn't do that anymore. Did he stop because she died?
Oh, no. Even before she died, he had stopped.
She looks at me and laughs.
I am talking way too much. Sorry.
So, but Blix left you the house, am I right?
She left you the building.
Surprisingly, yes. She stops walking so abruptly that two people nearly run into her.
How's Noah doing with that?
It's kind of a mess, I say. Noah and his mom believe that she should have been the one who got the house. And I kind of agree, if you want to know the truth. And no offense, but I don't really want to live here. So I guess I'll just sell it.
Oh, no.
Her face changes.
You're just going to sell it and go?
Well, yeah, I mean, this isn't really home, you know? I have a life elsewhere, in Florida. She is searching my face.
I hadn't even thought about that. Of course you have a life.
Oh, man. This would be like somebody in, I don't know, Oklahoma or somewhere, leaving me a house and expecting me to pick up and go there. It does feel kind of random. She shifts her bag over to her other shoulder and purses her lips.
I have got to tell you that this is so Blix-like. Doing something like this? No warning, no explanation. We all call this getting Blixed. Although mostly it works out for the best once the dust settles.
Ha! Huh. So I've been Blixed, I say.
You, my dear, have been so Blixed.
And you probably haven't even finished processing your breakup with Noah. That takes forever to get through. And you're going to have to start the whole thing all over again, now that he's all up in your face again and reminding you of the past.
Is he being weird? He is, isn't he? He's being weird, I can tell, just from the way he was last night.
He is being a little weird, I say. But I get it. He's in shock. She frowns.
Can I tell you something, even though I probably should just keep my big mouth closed and keep out of it?
Okay. She didn't want him or his family to have the building. She left it to you on purpose.
Really?
Yeah, she wasn't all that happy when he showed up. She comes to a full stop in front of a shop like she's slammed on the brakes.
Hey, this is one of my favorite stores, she says in the same chirpy tone of voice she's been using all along. Want to go in and look at the coats? You might need one.
Okay, I say, although Florida doesn't really call for a lot of coats.
Well, she says in a sing-song voice, but you never know what's going to happen when Blix is involved. You just might find she wants you to stay here.
Since she's dead, though, she doesn't have much of a way of getting that to happen, I say.
So you'd think, she says.
We go inside, and she goes over to the coats, starts flipping through all the shades of gray, black, and brown. And then suddenly, without warning, she stops moving and looks straight ahead, stiffening. I follow her gaze and see that a man is staring at her and making his way over to us, and behind him is Sammy. If Jessica were a cat, her back would be arched, and she'd be hissing.
Andrew,
she says, and her face has turned angry.
What in the world are you doing here? Aren't you supposed to be on the way to Cooperstown?
She looks around.
And where's your girlfriend, huh?
She reaches over and puts her hand on Sammy's arm, protectively. Sammy has a stricken expression on his face. I see him mouthing to her,
"It's fine, Mom. It's fine."
The man looks abashed, as though he's been caught at something, which is exactly how she sounds. Sammy, pushing his mop of too long hair out of his eyes, scoots out of her range and says,
"Easy, Mom. It's okay. We just wanted to get some food first, and now we're looking at gloves."
She turns to her axe.
"If I had known, Andrew, that your girlfriend wasn't going to cook for you, I could have fed him breakfast."
"It's fine. We had a nice breakfast down the street,"
I always like eating in this neighborhood.
Andrew puts his hand on Sammy's head, which I see Jessica register as some possible violation, and Sammy looks down miserably and kicks at something on the floor.
So, where is she?
Andrew mumbles something, and then the two of them glare at each other, and then he dips his head, smiles, and steers Sammy over to where they were before, the glove section.
Goodbye, she says. And don't come home later than you said, okay? We've got to stick to the schedule we agreed on, Andrew.
She turns to me. Let's get out of here. Do you mind?
Sammy is giving me an imploring look.
Me, like I could help.
Of course I don't mind, I say, and I smile at her son.
Sorry, that was awkward, she says. That man is constitutionally unable to stick to a plan, even if he's the one who made it.
So I'm not the only one processing about an ex, I say lightly, and am glad when she laughs.
Gah! No, I'll be processing this guy for the rest of my life if I'm not careful, she says.
By the time we get back to Yoke, after threading our way down the street as she points out the best places for beers, for East Asian clothing, for jewelry, for hamburgers, for muffins, for coffee, for everything, it's somehow become our turn to eat, and we snuggle into a tiny table near the back. The waiter comes by, a hot-looking guy with a black knit cap and red plastic glasses, and I order a cheese omelet with bacon, coffee, and whole grain toast and grits, and she says she'll have the same. As soon as he's moved on, she says,
okay, so we've established that we're both dealing with exes who are in our faces right now, but I don't really know the story of you and Noah. Before we get to be best friends, do you want to tell me what happened between you?
So I haul out the usual story, the wedding, the honeymoon, the walkout, all of it, minus the wedding gown dismantlement. And then a waitress comes by and puts two coffees down on the table, and I suddenly know that she has recently broken up with the waiter, and they've not been able to put things back together between them. But there's a guy walking down the street who would be perfect for her. Maybe she should take off her apron and take a few minutes off to go run into him. She could make it look all casual-like, or maybe the guy will come this way. He needs breakfast. He needs a hug. He needs her. At the next table, a couple is falling in love. Outside, a golden retriever has run down the sidewalk and is licking the face of a toddler. A toddler who laughs and says,
Mommy, I want doggy.
My head feels funny. It's like there's a golden light spreading over everything, like maple syrup poured on pancakes. I look up, and Jessica is smiling at me quizzically.
Jessica, I say,
you need to get back together with Andrew. You do know that, right?
24. Marnie. The maple syrup haze stays with me. It's like I'm moving in some sort of glow-filled fog. All the moments stand out somehow. Everything is brilliant and bright and etched in my brain like it will always stay in my memory. Even when Jessica laughs and assures me that she will not be getting back together with Andrew. No thank you, not now, not ever.
He is sleeping with someone else, she informs me icily.
But you match, I tell her. You both match. You don't see that?
She laughs, and then she pays the breakfast tab, and we walk back to the house, and along the way she says,
You and Blix with your get back together with Andrew talk. I'm beginning to see why she wanted you to have this house. So you could take up her song and dance about me and Andrew. Come on. Tell me the truth. Did she put you up to this?
No, I say, and feel that dazed, shaky sensation again, like the air is wobbling.
Well, Jessica says, I cannot forgive a man who's been unfaithful. Sorry, but that is a deal breaker, pure and simple. Period. No excuses. No backsies.
I try to remember exactly what Blix had said about all the people in her crazy little community.
Certainly she mentioned Lola and Jessica, but she just said that all of them needed love, and all of them were fearful of embracing it. But the thing is, I can almost feel her around me just now. Feel her thinking that Jessica and Andrew are meant to be together. Maybe that's what this hazy feeling is about. Listen, I say. One day I called her up when I was so miserable, when Noah left, and I asked her to do a spell to get us back together. I could tell she didn't think it was a great idea. She said she'd send some words for me to have a good life, for energy, for love. That's because she probably didn't think Noah was right for you. Also, I can't imagine her agreeing to manipulate somebody's path in that way. And then, right after that, I lost my job, which sucked, but then I moved back home, and then I fell in love again with Jeremy, my old high school boyfriend. So, that was obviously the spell she sent, right?
Well, it sounds like it.
Only now... Well, now I get the news that she passed away and that she left me her house, and I come here, and here's Noah. He's back in my life. So, what I want to know is this the spell? Is this what she intended to happen? She stares at me.
Wow. That's the way this stuff goes.
It might be the spell is working, or not. We don't know. I like to think I believe in free will.
I think Blix would say that you have to trust what makes you happy, she says. She was always telling me that. Trust joy. That's free will, isn't it?
My phone pings just then with a text message. I'm expecting it to be from Jeremy, but instead it's from a number I don't recognize.
Marnie, this is Patrick, downstairs. Sorry for the crashes last night. Cat knocked vase over, which fell into computer printer, drowning motor. Flashes of light ensued. Sparks. New printer being delivered next Monday. Cat very sorry. Told him he can't keep getting by on his looks. He's looking for a new apartment.
Jessica is watching my face. Patrick, I tell her. I smile and type back to him.
Yikes! Just make sure your wallet is safe when he decides to move out.
And he types,
too late, wallet already missing, and, coincidentally, tuna fish cans are arriving by the box load.
A few minutes later, he writes,
by the way, welcome to this house. Blix told me about you. Glad you're here at last. Hope you like it. It's crazy, but in a good way, I think.
The golden haze is still around me when I get back to Blix's house, where I find Noah practicing his guitar in the living room, and the haze is still there even when he sees me and wants to tell me again how he helped Blix over to the other side, and how he knew she should have called on the medical professionals, but instead she turned to him. Him! And how bad it feels that even doing that for her apparently wasn't enough. He's clearly been brooding about this all night long. But I am in this haze, like nothing I've ever been in before, you see, and everything seems so fraught with meaning. The haze stays with me through the 37 text messages, yes, 37, sent to me by my family members and Jeremy, asking what I'm planning to do, if I've listed the house for sale yet, when am I coming home, and, by the way, don't even tell them I like it in Brooklyn because we are not New York people. That from my sister, who says she is holding the baby while she types, and she just wishes I could somehow hear the gurgling sounds the baby makes when my sister tells her my name. Jeremy types over and over again, come home. The golden haze peaks when I happen to go outside and see a car pull up next door, and an elderly man gets out and goes up on the porch where Lola is waiting for him. He puts his arm around her, and Lola eases herself away from him, shifts her hip just so, and they walk down the steps together. She ducks into the car without even glancing in my direction. Noah goes out alone that night, and I get takeout and eat in my room, chatting with Jeremy on the phone. I tell him Brooklyn is big and dirty and complicated. He tells me that he went running on the beach, that it's still so warm he almost was tempted to go swimming, and that he had dinner with Natalie and Brian.
And guess what? I was the one who finally got Amelia to sleep, he says. She put her little head on my shoulder, and I walked her around and around the dining room table until she fell sound asleep.
That's so nice, I tell him. I want to tell him about the golden haze, but there are no words. It might be part of the magic, and Jeremy doesn't believe in magic. The haze has disappeared, though, when Noah and I get to Charles Sanford's office on Monday morning. Charles Sanford, a very nice-looking man with hair so slicked back it seems like it may have been buttered, studies us, sitting across the desk from him, and rattles his papers and lowers his spectacles, and then says a bunch of words in a very lawyerly voice that confirm the fact that Blix Holiday has indeed left me her house. Left it to me. Just me.
However, there's a stipulation,
says Mr. Sanford in a quiet, careful voice, looking at me.
And that is that you, Marnie, will have to agree to live in the house for 3 months before it is officially considered yours, meaning that you can't put it on the market until that period of time is up. Blix did not want you to simply sell the house and leave.
Noah exhales loudly. So it's not mine unless I live there? I say.
For 3 months,
says Mr. Sanford. 3 months. 3 months.
It's an unusual stipulation,
he says.
But then Blix was not a usual type of person, now was she?
He shrugs.
What can I say? That's the way she wrote it up. It doesn't have to start right this minute, of course. You can go get your affairs in order and come back.
But whenever I come back, it's for 3 months, I say.
Yes, that is correct. Perhaps you need some time to think it over.
I become seriously interested in the little hammered gold nails decorating the upholstered armchair I'm sitting in. I run my fingers across them again and again, tracing the indentations. The light in the room is purplish. The carpet is soft underneath my shoes. There's a tiny spider web in the upper left corner of the ceiling, near the window. My brain is ticking off the fact that 3 months will mean I'm there until the end of the year, pretty much. 3 months. 3 months. My whole family is going to be so upset, and I'll miss Jeremy. Taking a 3-month break from him is not what I would have chosen. Oh, and Amelia, too. I was just getting situated back in Florida, beginning to feel connected and secure. Damn it, I've been happy there. And after such a big, huge unhappiness, this has felt like a gigantic gift. Blix, what have you done to me? I'll need a coat. And sweaters? And what will I live on? And, oh my God, then there's Noah. I look over at him. He's holding a piece of paper in front of him, which I happen to know is a checklist of questions that he's been directed to ask by his mother. He starts in, his voice heavy and serious. Might there be another will that's more current somewhere? How do we know Blix was of sound mind? Can this will be contested? Blah, blah, blah. When he asks Charles Sanford point blank if I had any input into the terms of this will, and when exactly I was informed about it, I bristle and make a little squawking noise of protest. But Charles Sanford is patient, explaining that I had nothing to do with the terms of the will, but I can tell he's getting fed up with Noah and his family. And anyway, there's a loud buzzing sound in my ears that means I can barely pay attention anymore to what's being said. I work on rubbing the little nails in the chair and wonder what in the world Jeremy is going to say when he hears this news. Do I even want this? Yes. Yes, darling. You want this. somehow, while I've been consumed with my own anxieties, Charles Sanford seems to have found the combination of words to make Noah shut the hell up. And then we all say more words, and apparently I've agreed to everything because I'm signing papers, and it's growing darker outside, like the sun has disappeared, which I don't think has anything to do with the fact that I've just signed a scary legal document, but you never know. A thunderstorm is coming, LaRue says. Would anyone like some coffee or some bottled water? But no, we say we're fine.
Wait, one more question. So what if she doesn't live here for the 3 months?
Noah is saying in a voice that feels like it's coming from the bottom of a well, distorted and strange.
What happens to the property then?
Charles Sanford clears his throat and starts looking through the papers.
She was actually quite certain that Marnie would meet the stipulations. You know how your great-aunt was. There's hardly anything that she had doubts about. But in a separate document, sent in right before she died, she said that if Marnie didn't accept the terms, the house would go to several charities she named.
To charities,
says Noah flatly. He glances over at me in shock. I shrug.
Yes, Mr. Spinnaker. I know.
Charles Sanford clears his throat again.
She did leave you a bit of money. Not what you're hoping, I'm certain, but still. Your great-aunt did mention once that you're the heir to a rather large family fortune, so perhaps she didn't think it necessary to provide for you in her own will.
Well, that remains to be seen,
says Noah, in such a small, defeated voice that I feel sorry for him. I see him as a boy with his hand tucked into his great-aunt's hand, and maybe she is telling him something, and he is gazing into her face. Aunt Blix. Kiss your Aunt Blix, Noah. Charles Sanford is looking at him kindly.
Please know that this kind of thing happens all the time. There's no accounting for what people want done with their property when they're gone.
He turns to me.
And here, Marnie, is a private letter she requested that I give to you, to be opened when you wish. There's another letter in the vault for when the 3 months are up.
I reach over and take the letter. I still feel dazed. Perhaps it's not too late to speak up and change my mind. In 1 second, I could reverse course and my life would go right back to normal. Still, I can't help but notice that I am keeping silent. Charles Sanford stacks all the papers, and then he stands up to signal that the meeting is over.
So if you don't have any more questions, I'll file the necessary paperwork and get things moving. Marnie, feel free to contact me with any questions you might have, or if you have any problems going forward. Because you have chosen to accept the terms of the will, Blix has provided a stipend for you for your living expenses. I would suggest you open a bank account here, and I'll see that checks are deposited to the account as needed. Blix also wanted you to know that she's paid the taxes on the property for the next 5 years, and she's also provided some gifts for the tenants, which I'll be dispersing.
The blood is beating in my ears so hard that I can only barely hear what he's saying. It's time to go, apparently. Noah, walking along beside me, is reading his phone.
Just so you know, I'm pretty sure my folks will want to contest the will,
he says. We're in the waiting room by then. Charles Sanford frowns.
They are welcome to try, of course, but I assure you it's a waste of money and time. Your great-aunt was knowledgeable in how to make her wishes known.
Just then there's a huge clap of thunder, and Charles Sanford says,
Hi, Blix.
And everyone laughs.
You both have my deepest condolences on her loss,
Charles says, and he shakes our hands and says we'll be in touch. There is not a taxicab in the world that could contain both me and Noah right after that meeting, so I make sure to turn down the taxi he hails as soon as we get outside. He is a big brown bruise of a man just now, furiously texting with his mom, and I feel like I'm in a dream I can't wake up from. I decide to take my chances with the thunder and lightning and the rain that is splattering all around us. I wave him away and start down the street, pulling my sweater up over my head. As soon as I get to a Starbucks, a familiar landmark, I duck inside and find myself surrounded by a zillion rain-soaked people, all tapping on their phones and ordering skinny chai lattes. I'm shivering and reading the sign, trying to decide what to get, when a woman next to me says sharply,
"Are you online?"
Pardon?
I said, are you on this line or not?
Oh, you mean am I in this line? Yes. Oh, yes, I am, I say.
I thought you were asking me if I was online, like on the internet.
She stares at me, shakes her head, and then turns away, muttering about some people.
Huh.
So people in New York stand on lines instead of in them. Good to know. After I get my chai latte, I find an armchair in the corner that a guy with a laptop is just vacating and sink down into it. I'm going to be living in this city for 3 months. At the table next to me, two women are talking, leaning forward in intensity like no one else in the world is there. One of them has deep purple hair, and both of them have on coats that look like they're made of quilted black parachutes. And by the way, they're in love, and later today, they'll probably go out and get a dog. I need a coat, probably, and a job, a pair of warm gloves, more black clothing so I can fit in. I take a sip of my chai, and all of a sudden, just like that, I know that I don't want to be in Brooklyn. I want to go home. This is not a good place to live. It's dirty, it's loud, it's impersonal, and for heaven's sake, it doesn't even know how to have a proper thunderstorm. I like my thunderstorms to arrive in the late afternoon after a buildup of humidity and heat so that by the time the storm comes, you're grateful for it. It does its job, chasing out the sticky air, and moves on, and the sky clears right up. But this? This is a constant gray drizzle with intermittent booms that seem like it could go on all day. Who needs this? I tap my fingernails on the table, push all the crumbs into a little pile. Maybe I should go back to Charles Sanford's office and tell him that I've made a horrible mistake. I'll tell him that I'm simply not up to it. This was an amazing gift, totally amazing, and I am very appreciative of Blix's kindness, but sadly, I myself am not up to it. But thank you. Let the place go to a charity, and I'll take the next flight home tomorrow, and later this week I'll tell my family the good news that I'm marrying Jeremy. We'll go to Cancun for our honeymoon like Natalie and Brian did. In a few years, we'll have a kid, and then another, hopefully of the opposite sex, and I'll decorate the house and garden and join the PTA and drive in carpools and keep a color-coded calendar hanging on the kitchen wall. And get to say things like, honey, did you do your homework? I kind of love this idea. And in 30 or so years, I'll be there to help my parents when they need to move to a nursing home. Jeremy will close his physical therapy practice, and maybe we'll go back to Cancun for our 50th wedding anniversary when we're 80. And we'll say, where did the time go? Like everybody else in the history of the planet. And then we'll die fulfilled, and people will say, they were the luckiest ones. That's a life, isn't it? A person could do that. There will be so many, many good moments to that kind of life. So why does it feel like right this moment I'm at a crossroads, trying to decide between the unknown and the known, between the city and the suburbs, between risk and safety? Didn't I already make that choice? I told the guy I'd marry him. I kissed him right there in the diner, and I saw the happy look on his face and how surprised he was. And now all I have to do is tell him that there's a little piece of real estate that's holding things up. Blix, I am so sorry, but I already decided all this about my life. And now you've come to give me a gift that is going to muck up my whole life, and I'm sorry. But it's just such a huge, huge mistake. I am not the person you thought. I don't want a big, big life. I know that if I called Natalie right this minute and told her everything that's happening, she wouldn't even have to think about it. She'd say I should run, not walk, back to Charles Sanford's office this minute and insist that he rip up all the pages with my signature. Refuse to leave until every last shred of my signature is gone. I'm about to punch in her number when I remember that I am carrying a letter from Blix right in my handbag. With my heart pounding, I take it out and open it, somehow knowing it will change everything.
25. Blix. Dear Marnie, sweetheart, an hour ago I got off the phone with you. You were asking me for a spell to bring Noah back to you, a request that pierced me to the core of myself. You love him. You love him. At first I thought I'd go over to my book of spells. Yes, I really do have one. But it's more a joke than anything else, because the best spells just sort of happen without any need of external stuff. But then I thought, what the hell? I'd try to find just the thing you could drink or eat that would make you a magnet for Noah once again. Maybe it would be only a placebo spell, but it would work because that's how it all works. They work on belief and some directed energy. Here's the truth, sweet pea. We are all vibrational beings in physical bodies, and thoughts actually become reality, so you have to make sure you're thinking about what you want and not about what you don't want. But then it hit me. There's something else I can do instead, an immediate remedy. I could give you my house. My funny, weird, crazy Brooklyn house. I should tell you, it has a plumbing issue. The floors slope in some of the rooms. It's filled with tenants who don't have perfect lives. The light switch on the first floor flickers sometimes, and once it shot a spark at me. I shot one right back. There's a loose shingle on the roof. A tree branch batters the upstairs windows when storms come. What else? Oh, yes. One of the planters on the roof wobbles even though it's supposedly cemented in place. The sun coming up in the morning can shine directly in your eyes, even with the bamboo shades pulled all the way down. The full moon will wake you up if you sleep in the front bedroom. Still, that's the room I recommend. It's the best, because you will hear the sounds of the outside world, and that will keep you grounded and sane. It's a messy, forgiving, rambunctious house, filled with love and mischief. There have been so many good times here, and perhaps you already know the truth that good times beget other good times, and so there are plenty more to come. This house wants to be yours, and I want it to be yours. You and I are messy, forgiving, rambunctious people just like the house. That is what we share, Marnie dear. I hope you will stay. Because, you see, I am dying. I have this cancerous, tumorous thing growing inside me. It's been here with me for months, and I know the end is coming soon. I haven't told so many people, because sometimes people think I should go get treatment, like treatment is something I want to waste my time with. I do not want to have parts of me cut off, and I don't want to be burned and slashed and poisoned in the interest of getting better. I want the kind of treatment where the universe looks down and says, "Hey, Cassandra." Cassandra is the name I gave my tumor. I thought she deserved a name. I think the universe should have said, "Cassandra, you know you don't belong there. Get out of Blix's belly, will you, and go evaporate back into the atmosphere. Go turn into part of a glacier, or a little nest for a squirrel, or go back to wherever you were before you came here. Sweet Cassandra, if you kill off our Blix, then you will die too, because Blix has all the nutrients for you. So think about that." But the universe didn't come through with any such thing, and Cassandra apparently did not think about the consequences, and she has grown bigger and stronger, and she nestles down next to my heart when we lie together, and I know soon she will be the bigger part of me. So I'm excited for what I know can happen. I am calling my attorney, and I'm drawing up a will that leaves you the whole mess of a house. My heart beats faster when I think of how this is going to be for you. I know that the house will set your life off on a new course, just the way it did that for me. I know that you and I are in many ways connected, and maybe you'll feel that when you get here. Think of me here, welcoming you. Will you do that? See me on the rooftop, or sitting at the beat-up kitchen table drinking tea, or out on the street talking to the people who come by. I'm the car horns, the bus that rounds the corner, the subs over at Paco's across the street. I am all of it. And you are too, although you may not know it yet. I know, this will come as a shock to you, getting a house from someone you think you don't know. But I know you. I have always known you. And I see myself in you, believe it or not. And here's the main thing of what I know about you. I told you when we met that you are in line for a big, big life, and this, Marnie, is where you will find it. There will be love and surprises here in abundance, I promise you that. Be open to what doesn't seem possible, and you will be amazed what can happen. Darling, this is your time. Love over lifetimes, Blix. P.S. Will you stay for at least the 3 months it's going to take you to get over the shock of this? Please? Tally-ho, my love.
26. Marnie. I read the letter 3 or 4 or 10 times, then I fold it up carefully and put it back in my bag. For fun, I do the little exercise Blix showed me at the engagement party, the one where you beam some energy over to somebody you don't even know and watch what happens. I choose a baby in a high chair, banging his cup on the table in front of him. I picture him all bathed in white light and happiness, and then I wait to see the effect. And yep. He stops banging and looks around, and then his eyes meet mine, and he laughs out loud. I made a baby laugh. This is so cool. After the rain stops, I go to H&M to buy a sweater to replace the wet one I'm wearing. My eye gets caught by a long, bulky white cardigan, a black knit tunic, 3 pairs of leggings, a short black dress with red slashes on it, 4 pashminas, some heavy socks, 2 weeks' worth of underwear, most of it sexy, just because, and a blue knit cap. The clerk is ringing it all up while I'm looking at the jewelry display next to the counter, when a woman behind me in line, an older woman who has kind, crinkly eyes, says, "You need to buy that turquoise medallion there. Look at the shape of it. I think it's your good luck charm." So, of course, I buy it, but I have that weird feeling again. The maple syrup sensation. A good luck charm. Just what I need. When I turn around to show her that I've bought it, she's moved over to another cashier and doesn't look back. Outside, the weather has cleared up dramatically, and above the tall buildings, I can see wisps of white clouds scudding across the sky. The air feels clean and crisp. I put on the cardigan and go into the closest bank branch and start filling out the paperwork for an account. Apparently, I'm staying. It's not that Brooklyn suddenly looks so beautiful, or that I miss my family any less, or that I've come to a momentous decision. It's as though I can feel Blix's presence all around me, that her words have landed in my soul somehow, and I want to bask in that for as long as possible. 3 months suddenly seems like nothing. A little break from my life, perhaps, before it goes rumbling off on its normal track, toward marriage and children and, yes, lawnmowers. I have a chance to pause, I feel like that woman we sent energy to that time at the engagement party, and just the way she did, looking up to see who's called her. That's what I'm doing right now. I text Patrick for no reason at all. Just bought the heaviest sweater I've ever owned in my life. Question. Is life really possible for a kind of weird person from the South to make it here? After a long time, he writes back,
Sweater is a good start, although December can be frosty. Help, November can be frosty. Also, Brooklyn is welcoming to weirdos. It's normal folks who have the most trouble. But do you say y'all? Might be harder to assimilate if you say y'all.
I don't say y'all. My time in Northern California whipped that out of me.
By the way, nice punctuation. Colon and quotation marks.
Smiley face.
Then I'd say you have a good chance. I've been told I'm a punctuator extraordinaire.
If I can make it here, I can make it anywhere. Or so I've heard.
That's Manhattan. Making it in Brooklyn guarantees nothing.
So, I need a coat?
Most deaf. That's Brooklynese for most definitely.
I figured. I go over to Uniqlo and get one of those adorable little parachute-type coats in dark purple. Because why not? Then I walk home, trying out my part as a regular Brooklyn girl strolling through the hood. I'm staying. I'm actually going to live here for 3 months. I feel like when you're at the top of a roller coaster and are just about to start the whooshing ride you paid for, and you just hope you don't freak out. It's a long walk back to Blix's house, but I'm not up to figuring out the subway system just yet, and it's too nice a day for a cab. And anyway, what else do I have to do but walk? I just want to look at everything. All the nail salons and brownstones and nondescript apartment buildings and restaurants. Everything big and noisy and filled with ordinary life. For a while, I try keeping track of how many people smile at me, which is not all that many, but who cares? It occurs to me that when it's this crowded, you can't afford to be smiling and chatting with everybody. You'd be exhausted within 2 blocks. I see a woman sweeping her steps, and her brown arms in her floral print house dress look majestic. A bird's nest is perched in a ginkgo tree. A leaf on the sidewalk is shaped like a heart. And all three of those things feel like Blix saying, Welcome. You're here now. My entire family, of course, loses their respective minds when I tell them the news that I'm staying for a bit. But I'm ready for them. My mother calls it abhorrent and manipulative, and says Blix was probably certifiably crazy. My father says that I should come home and we can let our family attorney look over the papers.
No one can keep you against your wishes, he says. Believe me, I'll figure out how you can sell the property and still be at home.
It's not like that, I say, but they are not having any of that kind of talk. When I get Natalie on the phone, I try a different tack. I start with the good news that I just walked through Brooklyn and people smiled at me, and that even though it's loud and dirty here, it's also kind of amazing and full of stories, and that Blix was perhaps onto something when she said I needed to be here.
What? Says my sister. No to all of this. What happened to our plans to have babies and hang out by the pool? You said you were happy here. Why are you letting this woman, who's dead, by the way, change your whole life around?
It's not changing my whole life, I say. But the truth is, I'm not so sure. I finger the good luck charm I'm still wearing around my neck and listen to my sister's diatribe, which is getting more shrill by the minute. The thing about sisters is they have your whole rotten history right at their fingertips. She runs through the greatest hits of my misfit life. My admittedly checkered history of dropping the ball, changing the plan, not following through. How, sadly, it's no wonder that things go badly in my life. I assume she means my marriage, my job. When I let myself be swept along by somebody else's vision for me. Where is my backbone? What do I stand for? Think of Amelia. Think of Jeremy. Don't I care that people here need me? Our parents? I sit and listen, looking around the bright kitchen at my shopping bags on the floor, my new coat, my beautiful white sweater that she won't see. The sun is coming through the